Chapter 34. This president, unlike his predecessor, made decisions quickly and firmly without vacillating. He refused to take part in advisory meetings that took forever and accomplished little or nothing. And he particularly disliked aides running around lamenting or cheering the latest presidential polls. Conferences to build defenses against criticism from the media or the public failed to shake him. He was set on accomplishing as much as possible in 4 years. If he failed, then no amount of rhetoric, no sugar-coated excuses or casting the blame on the opposing party would win him another election. Party hacks tore their hair and pleaded with him to present a more receptive image, but he ignored them and went about the business of governing in the nation's interest without giving a second thought to whose toes he stepped on. Sandecker's request to see the president hadn't impressed White House Chief of Staff Wilbur Hutton. He was quite impervious to such requests from anyone who wasn't one of the party leaders of Congress or the vice president. Even members of the president's own cabinet had difficulty in arranging a face-to-face meeting. Hutton pursued his job as executive office gatekeeper overzealously. Hutton was not a man who was easily intimidated. He was as big and beefy as a Saturday night arena wrestler. He kept his thinning blonde hair carefully trimmed in a crew cut. With a head and face like an egg dyed red, he stared from limpid smoke-blue eyes that were always fixed ahead and never darted from side to side. A graduate of Arizona State with a doctorate in economics from Stanford, he was known to be quite testy and abrupt with anyone who bragged of coming from an Ivy League school. Unlike many White House aides, he held members of the Pentagon in great respect. Having enlisted and served as an infantryman in the Army, and with an enviable record of heroism during the Gulf War, he had a fondness for the military. Generals and admirals consistently received more courteous recognition than dark-suited politicians.
"Jim, it's always good to see you,"
he greeted Sandecker warmly, despite the fact that the admiral showed up unannounced.
"Your request to see the president sounded urgent, but I'm afraid he has a full schedule. You needn't have made a special trip for nothing."
Sandecker smiled, then turned serious.
"My mission is too delicate to explain over the phone, Will. There is no time to go through channels. The fewer people who know about the danger, the better."
Hutton motioned Sandecker to a chair as he walked over and closed the door to his office.
"Forgive me for sounding cold and heartless, but I hear that story with frequent regularity."
"Here's one you haven't heard. 16 days from now, every man, woman, and child in the city of Honolulu and on most of the island of Oahu will be dead." Sandecker felt Hutton's eyes delving into the back of his head.
"Oh, come now, Jim, what is this all about?"
"My scientists and data analysts at NUMA have cracked the mystery behind the menace that's killing people and devastating the sea life in the Pacific Ocean." Sandecker opened his briefcase and laid a folder on Hutton's desk. "Here is a report on our findings. We call it the acoustic plague because the deaths are caused by high-intensity sound rays that are concentrated by refraction. This extraordinary energy then propagates through the sea until it converges in surfaces, killing anyone and anything within a radius up to 90 kilometers. Hutton said nothing for a few moments, wondering for a brief instant if the admiral had slipped off the deep end, but only for an instant. He had known Sandecker too long not to take him as a serious, no-nonsense man dedicated to his job. He opened the cover of the report and scanned the contents while the admiral sat patiently. At last he looked up.
"Your people are sure of this?"
"Absolutely," Sandecker said flatly.
"There is always the possibility of a mistake."
"No mistake," Sandecker said firmly.
"My only concession is a less than 5% chance the convergence could take place a safe distance away from the island." "I hear through the congressional grapevine that you've approached Senators Raymond and Ibarra on this matter, but were unable to get their backing for a military strike against Dorset Consolidated Property. I failed to convince them of the seriousness of the situation."
"And now you've come to the president."
"I'll go to God if I can save 2 million lives."
Hutton stared at Sandecker, head tilted to the side, his eyes dubious. He tapped a pencil on his desktop for a few moments, then nodded and stood,
convinced that the Admiral could not be ignored. "Wait right here," he commanded. He stepped through a doorway that led to the Oval Office and disappeared for a solid 10 minutes. When he reappeared, Hutton motioned Sandecker inside. "This way, Jim. The President will see you." Sandecker looked at Hutton. "Thank you, Will. I owe you one." As the Admiral entered the Oval Office, the President graciously came from around President Roosevelt's old desk and shook his hand. "Admiral Sandecker, this is a pleasure. I'm grateful for your time, Mr. President. Will says this is an urgent matter concerning the cause of all those deaths on the Polar Queen. And many more." "Tell the President what you told me," said Hutton, handing the report on the acoustic plague to the President to read while the Admiral explained the threat. Sandecker presented his case with every gun blazing. He was forceful and vibrant. He believed passionately in his people at Neuma, their judgments and conclusions. He paused for emphasis, then wound up by requesting military force to stop Arthur Dorset's mining operations. The President listened intently until Sandecker finished, then continued reading in silence for a few more minutes before looking up. "You realize, of course, Admiral, that I cannot arbitrarily destroy personal property on foreign soil." "Not to mention the taking of innocent lives," Hutton added. "If we can stop the operations of only one of the Dorset consolidated mines," said Sandecker, "and prevent the acoustic energy from traveling from its source, we could weaken the convergence enough to save nearly 2 million men, women, and children who live in and around Honolulu from an agonizing death." "You must admit, Admiral, acoustic energy is not a threat the government is prepared to guard against. This is completely new to me. I'll need time for my advisors on the National Science Board to investigate NUMA's findings." "The convergence will occur in 16 days, said Sandecker darkly. "I'll be back to you in 4, the President assured him. "That still leaves us plenty of time to carry out a plan of action," said Hutton. The President reached out his hand. "Thank you for bringing this matter to my attention, Admiral," he said in official jargon. "I promise to give your report my fullest attention." "Thank you, Mr. President," said Sandecker. "I couldn't ask for more." As Hutton showed him out of the Oval Office, he said, "Don't worry, Jim. I'll personally shepherd your warning through the proper channels." Sandecker fixed him with a blistering glare. "Just make damn sure the President doesn't let it fall through the cracks, or there won't be anyone left in Honolulu to vote for him."